Tiff, the meta level stuff on this episode is fascinating to me. There's some big names.
Yeah, I mean, we have kind of like a famous director in this one, and we also have some guest stars, but like the guest stars were like originally kind of going to be the main star, but they got passed over.
Yes.
So let me just say what we're talking about. We are talking about the episode Moving On, which is season 9, episode 16, originally airing on February 14th, 2013. Also, this should have been the Valentine's Day episode, but we had one the day before Valentine's Day. We do have kind of like a cold room temperature open, but before we get into that, let's dive into that meta stuff.
Yeah, so this is directed by Jon Favreau. Did little things like, I don't know, Iron Man, a bunch of the Avengers stuff. Apparently on Friends, you told me before we hit record.
Yeah, I hope that was Jon Favreau. I think so. Yeah, that sounds familiar.
We're just gonna go with it.
Sure. Why Google it?
Yeah, why bother? big names. And The Office has had a history of pretty famous directors, but also a lot of people's first time directing. Like a lot of the cast got to direct over the series. But yeah, Jon Favreau is here. You mentioned the episode number. This on streaming is 2 episodes, part 1 and part 2. Part 2 starts with the rare previously on segment, which we don't get very often in The Office. But originally, it aired as one long episode that ran about 41 minutes. And so we're going to treat it as one long episode, even though when watching along with us, it may be 2, depending on where you watch. But it aired as one, and that's kind of how we're going to treat. There's a couple more of these coming up, and that's kind of how we're going to treat them as one long episode.
Why do you think they did that? Like, it was aired as one. We've had 40-minute episodes before. It's not a weird thing. Like, and then they had to stick in that strange previous on stuff and like recap moments. I felt like it pulled you out, especially in streaming when it's supposed to be like seamless watching of like episode after episode. It's like it was better when it was on TV, and then they added in like all the annoying TV stuff as if they split up the episode, but they didn't.
Yeah. And sometimes there are issues with like production numbers, and there's a lot of things that I think go into that, but it was weird. It took me out of it because I watched them back to back. And it also makes part 2 a little bit shorter than it could have been otherwise. Because you have like, I mean, I'm sure it's not. It felt like 5 minutes of previously on stuff. I'm sure it was just like a minute and a half or something.
No, it was really long. Like I had to skip through it. I'm like, okay. Like, I don't know. I was just annoyed by that. And production code wise, it's one production code. It's 9017. Like, I don't know what made them do that. Maybe they just needed to like fill up the discs when there were discs. I don't even know.
It's definitely strange. But the thing that tickles me most about this episode is that we see Bob Odenkirk, who of course super famous, like his career is just unbelievable. But he had gone out for the Michael Scott part 9 or 10 years before this episode. And we'll get to him, but the character that he plays is very Michael Scott-esque. And I mean, I love Bob Odenkirk. He was amazing in everything I've ever seen him in. And so when I get to this episode, I'm always so thrilled that he got to play a very Michael Scott character. Because, you know, if you're just know Bob Odenkirk from like Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, Those are dramas, right? And Better Call Saul is kind of a dark comedy in places. But Bob Odenkirk is hilarious. And getting to see him in sort of full-blown humor mode in this episode is just, it's a real treat every time.
So the main part of the episode, it opens up in, I don't know, is this a room temperature open?
I called it an angry open.
Yeah, because it's like, so Andy is getting kind of like a heated lecture from David Wallace about being gone.
No, you lied to me, Andy. You pretended to be in this office for 3 months and you were sailing on your boat.
I resent that. I never lied to you.
Really? Hey, David, all is good in Scranton, PA.
And all was good in Scranton, PA that
day. By the way, Oscar says hi.
Oscar says hi all the time. He says all kinds of greetings. Hi, hello, hola. You're telling me you've never heard Oscar say hi,
Andy?
So we can assume that this is like right on the heels of the previous episode. But then the rest of the episode takes place like maybe about a week later.
Yeah.
So it's like the open follows the previous episode and we get like kind of that closure of what did David Wallace think about Andy being gone for so long. Turns out he's not happy, not happy about it. But he's not going to fire Andy because he feels some sort of loyalty to him, because if it weren't for Andy, he wouldn't own the company.
It's super interesting that he goes about it that way, because, I mean, come on, like super fireable offense here. And Andy doesn't really do himself any favors in the meeting. He's kind of a smart aleck throughout the meeting. But the timing definitely jumped out at me as well. And like, we know that he has to travel some to get to Scranton. So like in my head canon, this was like, oh, this is like the next day or a couple of days later or something. But definitely, I mean, he goes on to like, he's on very thin ice. So I feel like any loyalty that David Wallace feels to Andy, like, this is it, right? Like, there's nothing past this. Like, they're even now.
He spent it.
Yeah, yeah. All the capital's been spent. And, yeah, he gets to keep his job. My favorite part about this is that people are watching this because it's going on in the conference room. And as we know, if you yell in the conference room, everyone can hear you. My favorite little moment, though, is we see Kevin at reception and he's snacking like he's watching a movie. It cracked me up.
So, yeah, all throughout this episode, I can't stand Andy. We are back to kind of like super annoying Andy. There are moments where he is kind of acting like Michael Scott. Like this Andy that has come back from the boat trip is like the Andy of the first, you know, season that we knew him, where he was super annoying before his character was, you know, quote unquote, fixed by anger management. But like, I don't know where this Andy came from, but he is certainly not likable in any situation he has been in since he has gotten back from his boat trip. Maybe it was like the Ed Helms filming another movie with that kind of made, I don't know. Maybe the writers are angry at him for leaving and they're writing him to be this big jerk. But whatever it is, I am not an Andy fan. And not that I really was a deep Andy fan. I liked him. I thought he contributed. But now I'm just annoyed by him in every sense.
Yeah. When people talk about this late arc, you know, like, oh, they ruined Andy. And I don't know if that's necessarily how I feel about it. I kind of feel like this guy is, I mean, he's always made bad decisions, right? He's always been sort of emotionally immature, and maybe this is it finally like coming to a head in a way that it hasn't before. And so I get it, and like, I agree with you. I think he's terrible, terrible person in this episode. But it's not, to me, it doesn't feel as out of left field as maybe some people feel like it does. I don't know. I'm conflicted about it for sure.
So in this episode, we have a ton of plots to follow, especially because it's double long. So it's almost like the second part of the episode picks up the extra plot with Toby and Nellie. But starting from the beginning, we have Andy having a hard time with Aaron dating someone else or being able, like, before he knows that she's dating someone else, Andy's having a hard time getting over Aaron. And so that drives kind of that main plot between Andy, Aaron, and Pete. Then we have Pam is going to Philly to have an interview for a new job. And we have Dwight taking care of his Aunt Shirley, and he gets Angela involved. And then finally, we have the Toby and Nellie plot at the end kind of tacked on there. So I say we follow the Andy plot first, since it's kind of it takes up the most time and feeds into both sides of this episode. And we save Pam and Jim for last. And we finish out with them, since we've been following their drama and their relationship pretty closely for the last few episodes.
That works for me.
So Andy, he's crying in his office loudly for everyone to hear. He's very upset.
Yeah, Andy's just a mess. It reminded me very much of the Christmas episode where Carol breaks up with Michael and he's like laying on the ground moaning. It had that kind of vibe to it to me.
He sounds like a wounded animal.
Should have put him out of his misery and just fired him.
I can't be around sad people. It makes me sad.
I'm the same way with horny people.
He can't understand why Erin isn't also like grieving this relationship, although she was the one that ended it.
That's right.
But he's having a really hard time accepting this. And he goes back into the annex, into the bro zone, to talk to Clark and Pete about, or should I say Clark and Plop, to talk about his feelings about Erin.
She got rid of it. My blue sweater. What is that about?
I was just like, stay.
We are in the bro zone lair. Okay, Nard Dog Plop and Clark are Posey, aka Clark Hork Orange. Here's the sitch. Erin dumped me. Natch. But she got rid of my blue sweater, which was her favorite. Is she moving on a little fast, or am I being a total psycho? Plop, you go first.
I don't know. Women do tend to move on quicker than men.
Survey says, doesn't make me feel better at all.
Sorry.
Zero Clark 30. What do you got?
Well, look at it this way. Being a bachelor is not all bad. I mean, you got your freedom now.
Last night, I ordered a pizza by myself, and I ate it over the sink like a rat.
There you go. Good for you.
Yeah.
Andy, yeah, he doesn't know about Pete yet, and he goes to talk about this sweater that she didn't break up with him till he came back, but she's been over this relationship for a lot longer than he's been aware of it, right? So we see Erin being much further down the road of dealing with this breakup than he is, and Andy's like trying to make this sweater a thing. So he goes to talk to the guys in the annex, and it's one of many very funny, ironic scenes in this. So they're talking about this sweater. My favorite line of the scene is, after Andy leaves, Clark tells Pete that he'll give him $100 if he wears that sweater to work the next day.
I'll give you $100 to wear that sweater to work tomorrow.
I love that, too. I love that it implies that Clark totally knows about the relationship between Erin and Pete. But Erin and Pete are kind of keeping it on the DL for now, to spare Andy's feelings. And also, as Erin says, because it's a little bit hot. But they're not rubbing it in anyone's face. Like, it's not super clear. I don't think most of the office really knows that they are together. Nellie probably knows because of her previous engagement with them before. But yeah, they are not outwardly saying that they're in a relationship. So Andy has no idea, but I love that sweater comment from Clark. And it totally shows that he's 100% aware of what's been going on.
Andy does eventually find out because he, in a completely inappropriate move, as Erin gets up to go do something, he snoops through her phone, which she leaves at reception, which is horrific, completely inappropriate. And people tell him that, like, the bullpen's like, look, what are you doing? That's wrong. And then he kind of lashes out at them. But he discovers this text thread with a guy named Pete, who he doesn't know is sitting back in the annex because he's forgotten his real name.
I found out she's been texting a guy named Pete. Does anybody know a Pete?
Pete. Pete what?
It just occurred to me that Andy has been calling me Plop for so long he forgot my real name, which is Pete.
I think going through the phone really shows like Andy's state of mind. He's making a bunch of really bad decisions here.
Yeah, and it wasn't until that Andy opens the refrigerator and sees a bag with Pete's name written on it that he makes the connection of which Pete or who is actually Pete. And he remembers that Pete is Plop and Plop is Pete. And he tries to entrap him with an STD scare that he has him into his office. He mispronounces the word chlamydia, which is very unlike an Andy character. Like, because I was reading about this online, of course, because we do a little research about each episode, and I thought it was completely true, was that, like, Andy went to Cornell. Like, he has a good vocabulary. He is intelligent. Like, there's no reason why he wouldn't have been able to pronounce the word chlamydia. And it is very much like a, he is written in this episode to be very Michael Scott.
Yeah.
Just like you said, it's very much like he's on the, like, rolling on the floor. Well, Andy's not rolling on the floor, but, like, the crying and the whining, like, it's so Michael breaking up with somebody. It's Michael mispronouncing words. Like, this isn't Andy. This is like a Michael clone here. And so this eventually gets Pete to admit that, yes, he is seeing Aaron, and Andy just can't handle it.
Yeah, he's really struggling. Look, he ate a pizza above his sink like a rat. I mean, that's not a healthy move.
I mean, sometimes you gotta just get through that awful, you know, rat pizza phase and move on. Like, you have to go through all the stages of grief, really. And one of them is eating an entire pizza, you know, basically over a trash can. Like, you just gotta get it done. But he goes to Toby and he tries to get Pete fired. And this we have seen Andy do before with Nelly. And again, Toby reminds him that you just can't fire people. Even though you're the boss and you are trying to, you have to have, like, a real business cause and not a personal one.
And we learned that they've already signed a love contract.
All right. Well, look, while I have you, this is a relationship disclosure form for Pete and Aaron.
They already have a contract? It's just mutually agree to... Every phrase is like a dagger in my crotch.
He's really upset by the love contract and crumples it up. And Toby plays it pretty cool here. He insists that it wasn't the original and nothing Andy can do is going to change this. But it was the original, because I love that little shot of Toby trying to smooth out the paperwork that Andy just crumpled up.
Andy just keeps lashing out at people. So after Toby says you can't fire him, he storms off and he goes to let everybody else know that he's unhappy with them. You let a guy named Plop steal my girlfriend.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. You guys are supposed to have my back, okay? Instead, you let a guy named Plop steal my girlfriend.
Hey, boss, I did everything I could. I invited Pete out for drinks. I emailed him shots of my junk.
Ugh.
Kid doesn't have a romantic bone in his body.
Come on, Andy, they're a good match.
That doesn't matter, okay? What matters is that I am hurt.
Andy's whole life is a booger bubble. That's just where we are.
Andy.
What?
Andy, you got a booger bubble going on there.
Sorry.
It's okay.
My whole life is a booger bubble.
Yeah, everyone throws up their hands and they're like, look, Andy, we're not responsible for your love life. We, you know, we aren't the guardians of people in this office and their relationships. I do love that Meredith, during these, you know, talks back and forth in the bullpen here, that she's still adjusting her wig. I think that's great. We still have that running gag. Almost every episode since she shaved her head, there's been like a little bit of a Meredith wig bit, and I'm here for every single one of them. I love it. Every time she's wearing a different color wig, it's totally like usually askew on her head in some way. Like, it's a very obvious wig situation, and I love it. But Andy reacts to all of this in a really vengeful, childish way. And when Pete and Aaron come into Andy's office to try and talk to him and be like, look, we all have to work together. Let's try and put this behind us. Let's try and, like, you know, get through this. It's going to be awkward at first, but, like, we can do this, right? Like, we can make this work. And Andy decides to show them firsthand just how awkward it is working around an ex.
This is terrible. So he makes two hires. The first is a woman named Alice that comes out in the episode that, you know, Pete's been through a breakup before. He's trying to be empathetic to Andy. It mentions this woman. And she's a marketing consultant. And she comes in and Aaron doesn't know who she is. And so she leads him back to the annex. And then it all kind of explodes that they used to go out, and Aaron, after a beat, puts it together. And as she goes to run to confront Andy about this, We see none other than Gabe. Gabe is back. He lost 50 pounds, but he gained it right back. He's there. And so he is putting their exes into the workplace to make them feel the way that he feels.
I guess he figured, like, if he can't fire them, he might as well hire other people to get back at them. So he's using his power that he actually does have and making everything awkward for everyone. And a lot of stuff comes out about each person. Gabe has a couple, like, really funny lines, like, it very Gabe fashion about, you know, just how disturbing and awkward he is. And Erin's reaction to everything that Gabe says is just hilarious. She's absolutely disgusted. She can't even physically handle it. Like, she's shuddering most of this mm-hmm. part of the episode. And it's so funny.
Just wanted to check in. How was everyone's day?
Honestly, it was a little weird.
Really? That's interesting, because Erin and Pete thought it wouldn't be weird at all. Why do you think it was weird, Gabe? Maybe because you and Erin used to be an item?
I still wear Erin's button bands around the condo sometimes, so it feels to me like we're still in a relationship.
Gabe!
A lot of the time. Oh.
But we find out, you know, that Pete's ex really isn't that, you know, thrilled about him either. She's thrown a lot of shade about a lot of things that he did, which honestly don't even seem that bad. You know, like, all the stuff that is getting thrown around, it's really not bad. Like, it's said with a lot of vengeance between all these exes, but it's fine. It's as it is. It's growing up. It's life.
So you're dating a secretary now? Moving up in the world, Pete.
She's nice to me.
How's that PE degree coming? That's what he wanted to be. His dream in college was to be a gym teacher.
Well, guess what? He could still be a gym teacher. In fact, we could all still be gym teachers. So let's...
I technically cannot. I don't have the lung capacity to blow a whistle.
Oh, my God.
But Andy, like, puts everyone into the conference room together. They have a confrontation about how the day went with everyone working together. And it just erupts in a tremendous fight. And Andy is delighted because he is finally getting his vengeance. He is seeing everyone else upset, so it's making him feel better. Andy's terrible. We can all agree on that.
I'll shovel his sashimi into his mouth with a spork.
All right. All right. Yes, that is a legitimate question. Does making Erin and Pete feel bad make me feel better?
He's a simian fool.
No, he's
and
not.
He's...
Yeah. Yeah. It does.
So that's kind of where we leave this plot, where Andy forces Erin and Pete to be as uncomfortable as he felt.
Yeah, Andy has this, like, really smug look on his face when everyone's arguing in the conference room, and I just kind of want to smack him. Is that bad? Does it make me a bad person? I don't think it does.
No, no, not at all. I mean, I feel like he needs a good little, like, get with it, dude. Like, come on.
Terrible.
But this is also the last we see of Gabe. So he had a little repeat cameo, and then he's off again to wherever Gabe's go.
Well, he's got that Nike tattoo, so he can go anywhere.
I got a tattoo for you.
I didn't ask you to get that Nike swoosh. Nobody did. You did that for you.
Just do it. You were the it that I was just doing.
Now I'm shuddering.
He'll go to Silicon Valley and become someone's
That's
assistant.
Merging two shows.
That's my headcanon. I like to bring characters like through their journeys and connect them to different shows.
We'll come back to that next week when we talk about the farm. but let's talk about Dwight and Angela. We see Dwight on a phone call, and I love the way this is set up. He's like, don't let her eat the grass. Like, is he talking about a farm animal, a sick dog?
No, don't just let her eat the grass. She'll puke it right up. Okay, just put out two bowls and see which feed she prefers. I'm sorry to be taking up so much of your precious time, Mose, but she's your aunt, too. Fine, I'll see what I can do.
But once again, Dwight referring to people as farm animals, and they have an Aunt Shirley who lives on some adjoining property, and she's older, and her health isn't very good. She's not able to, like, keep herself clean. And Dwight turns to Angela for help by doing the very mature thing of hiding between some vending machines and popping out whenever Angela shows up.
I need you.
Dwight!
And you should take breaks more often. I've been waiting there for 45 minutes.
What?
What is it?
It's my aunt, Shirley. She's on her last legs.
Dwight, that's awful.
I have no idea. I mean, her hair, her clothes, it's all falling off in great big clumps. And we need someone to go out there and clean her up. We had a nurse, but she quit because she was poisoned by Aunt Shirley.
What do you mean by poison?
Well, probably nothing. Or strychnine. Or lemonade and strychnine, which is actually what it was.
Okay, well, I'm very sorry about your aunt.
Thank you.
But I don't see how this is my problem.
Previously, we saw that Dwight helped out Angela, so he's calling in this favor that Angela now needs to give him a hand.
Yeah. Poor Angela. Poor Aunt Shirley. Poor Dwight. Everything about the storyline is sad and uncomfortable. But Angela's going to go, and they're going to give her a bath and give her some clothes and
give her some schnapps.
Yeah, a lot of schnapps to make this happen. Aunt Shirley's very unpleasant.
Aunt Shirley, hello, it's me, Dwight.
Oh, looky here, it's Big City Dwight. Careful you don't get mud on those fancy town shoes, Big City Dwight.
Hello, Aunt Shirley.
And who's this little kitchen witch? She's so tiny, like a little kitchen witch.
This is Angela, and we brought you some new clothes.
New clothes? What for?
Oh, dear God.
Oh, okay.
You know what? Before you put the new clothes on, Angela's going to get you cleaned up a little bit.
Yes. How would you like a nice warm bath?
How would you like a mean cold slide?
Ow!
It's very funny to me, Dwight's sort of humor on the farm. It's like, oh, no, like it's a rustic shower with lots of privacy. And then we see it's like a metal lawn chair with a chain on it. It is rustic. It's also rusty, though. And you don't want to mix those things up when it comes to showering.
I mean, Shirley kind of seems fine with it now that she's full of a half liter of schnapps, but like homemade schnapps, too. But like she seems like, all right, this is how you shower. Angela puts her foot down. She absolutely refuses after blasting Dwight with a fire hose, which, as we know, the force is insane. Also, I have to ask. So later on in this episode, it's brought up that it's February. And they're outside with a hose in Pennsylvania. Like, it is cold in February. And so I think that they're California showing a little bit here in that they didn't think that some scenes outdoors with some water wouldn't be a good idea for a show taking place in February. So there's that little discontinuity there, which definitely stood out to me this time. I noticed it for sure. Other times, I've never noticed it, so I'm sorry for wrecking it for our listeners right now, if you didn't notice. But Angela puts her foot down, like I said, and she is going to give Aunt Shirley a proper bath and a proper hairstyle, and she is going to treat her like a person and take care of her. And everyone respects Angela's authority, because when Angela puts her foot down, she's a little scary. So they fall in line.
I'm going to give your aunt a proper bath and a haircut like a lady. And you two are going to shut up about it. Do you have a bathtub?
Yes, ma'am.
Good.
We get this moment that I really like where she's braiding her hair. And Dwight is kind of watching from the doorway with real, like, he's like smiling. And like, he's feeling, I think, what he has missed with Angela. Right. Like he's looking at her and in a very like loving and sweet way. And she catches his eye. And then a little bit later, they're having a meal and they're sort of playing house a little bit. Right. And we kind of get a glimpse of what life could be like for them if they were together. And this sort of comes to a head out on the porch where he goes to kiss her. And she's like, I can't. Like I made a vow. I'm married to the senator. And then Dwight says that he respects that, that, you know, if she were his, he would want her to be faithful. And it's a moment in their relationship. And I feel like maybe for the first time, they're finally sort of being honest about where they are. Right. Because for years and years, they were in secret. And then she was engaged to Andy, but still sleeping with him. And now they're kind of at this place where they're just being honest with each other that she can't, and he understands. And it's just a really sweet moment between the two of them. It is colored a little bit by the fact that Aunt Shirley brings up whatever Mose did to his lady scarecrow friend, which I do not need to know about. But it's nice.
Do you like the stink sack?
Is it any good?
No, you don't eat it. It's a toy, like a wishbone. You know, prettiest girl gets the stink sack.
Thank you.
So, when's the wedding?
We are just friends.
That's what Mose said about his lady scarecrow, and look what he did to that poor thing.
Yeah, their adoring attitude towards each other. It's like when you look at someone that you are, you know, really in love with, and you see them being caring with someone, and it's just like, or like, you know, you see like, I don't know, I remember like dating someone and you see them like being sweet with mm-hmm. children.
Yeah.
You just like get that look, you know, they get that feeling of like, oh, this is, you know, a glimpse into how they would be, you know, if in our life together. And so I really do like the scene out on the porch with Angela and Dwight, but like my question is here is that like, so Dwight asks her to leave the senator.
Dwight.
Right. Not outside. The horse flies. You know what? My farm is only a few acres east of here. Or we could use the slaughterhouse.
No, Dwight. The senator.
Leave him. He probably won't even notice that you're gone. Be with me, monkey.
I can't be your monkey, Dwight.
I'm not talking about some frisky romp in the warehouse. We have wasted too much of our lives ignoring the fact that we belong together. The 80 or 90 years that I have left of this life, I want to spend with you.
You know, he's like, let's stop playing this game. Mm-hmm. Like, time to give this up. Like, you know that your relationship with the senator is basically, like, based on so many lies. I mean, even before we know that Dwight and Angela have been sleeping together, even after she has been with the senator. So we have that fact as well. And now Angela is putting her foot down about being faithful, even though she also has like kind of this more open relationship with the senator because the senator is allowed to be with Oscar. There's a lot going on. And it makes me question why now that Angela decides to, you know, push Dwight away a little bit and say like, hey, I can't do this. Maybe is it because Dwight is actually saying like, hey, this isn't just like a, you know, fun romp in the hay kind of situation or like a quick little sleep together, that this is a I want to be with
maybe.
You. That it's he's throwing out a much more serious offer that maybe she's a little bit afraid to take. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely complex. And I think that's good because they have all this really complicated history. And so being honest, but a little out of sync, like it totally works, I think.
Yeah. I really like watching these two kind of fall back in love with each other. And maybe that's it too. This is like a very intimate thing that they just went through. Like you said, it's almost like a glimpse of what life together would be like. Much more than, you know, just meeting up in the warehouse kind of thing. And so like that's a bigger step. Maybe that's where she's hesitant from. And it's like, you know, just one day of that, you don't want to, you know, destroy your whole life just for a one day glimpse. Right. You know, she has to be pretty sure. And they have been so rocky for so many years that that's probably a really scary prospect.
I think she wants more with Dwight than just the warehouse hookups, right? But to your point, mm-hmm. like that means a lot more now than it did when she was single and didn't have a child. And so it's heavier in a way. And I think we've all been in that situation before. Like, you know, you said, like, if you're dating somebody and you see them interact with kids, like I definitely remember that when Mary and I were dating when we were a lot younger. And it can be exciting, but also a little scary. And so they have to navigate this. And right now, even though I think Dwight handles it pretty well in terms of how he responds to her, they're not strictly on the same page. And so we will see more of how this unfolds. But I like where this episode gets the two of them.
So let's touch on the quick Toby Nelly situation, because that's just kind of this minor little plot going on in this episode. Toby is still talking Nellie's ear off about the Scranton Strangler, and Nellie is just fed up.
We should catch up.
You know, I've been going over my notes from the trial.
Oh, no, like Toby,
I may have lost over a few minor points.
No. Toby, you cannot keep blathering on about this Scranton Strangler. Do something about it. Get it out of your system, whatever it takes.
I've been drafting a letter.
For 2 years. Then what? Another year picking out a stamp? Another 6 months before you decide to lick it? Just... I don't want to hear it.
She tells him to shut his mouth, stop talking about it. You're driving me nuts. If you are feeling like something went wrong, you gotta have some action. You can't just keep talking about it to me. It's enough already.
Yeah. And this pushes Toby into action. He's gonna go to the prison. We learned the Strangler's name, George Howard Scubb. As Daryl points out, that's a devil name. You know, the three names, those people are always...
Yep, it's a serial killer name for sure.
It's a serial killer name. But he tells the camera crew, staying outside the prison, so I guess he's in prison nearby, that he's going to go tell George that he thinks he's innocent, and that, you know, if they start a friendship, then that's fantastic. But no expectations, but he'll probably want to hug me.
This is the prison. I am not going in there with... expectations, per se. I will meet George Howard Scubb. I will tell him that I believe he is innocent. I would understand if he felt motivated to hug me. I would understand if a friendship began. How did Bogart put it? I think this is a start of my first friendship.
It's because Toby is the real strangler.
Maybe.
See? See, it all comes back around. Now's the time. Go look up those theories if you haven't yet. We keep talking about it on this show. I keep bringing it up anyway. But this is kind of like the, why would he doubt that? Why would he want to be friends with this person? It's like, do they feel a camaraderie? Like, are they both strangling? Like, be like, hey, let's talk about our stranglings together.
Or, you know, he feels guilty that this guy went to jail. And
it's a simple explanation. It's never right.
It doesn't go well. Well, he does get a hug, but it's just around the throat.
Yeah.
And
very, very directed hug.
Yes. We see this as kind of a heavy shot for the office. We see like EMTs and a stretcher going into the prison. It's like, whoa, what happened? And Nellie apparently goes to pick him up and his vocal cords are injured. This is the second time that Toby's been in a neck brace in the show. Remember when he went to Jamaica?
Costa Rica.
And hurt himself ziplining the first day. So now Toby is in this neck brace. He can't talk. And Nellie's like, well, it was very brave. And then she kind of has this moment of like, it actually was kind of brave. And so like, is she a little more into him now? It's just kind of left open-ended. But she definitely like restates it and kind of has this look as she's like, oh, I actually kind of respect what he did.
You offered your neck in search of the truth. The proud neck of justice, isn't that the expression? Yeah, well, anyway, it was very brave. It really was quite brave.
All right, I guess it's Pam and Jim time. So Pam is taking some steps to meet Jim halfway, I think. And we saw, like, you know, their last episode, their Valentine's Day didn't go so well. We assumed that they had kind of a fight, or maybe they didn't, but I don't know. But they did spend Valentine's Day together. And it seems like they came to a conclusion that Pam might be looking for a job in Philly. So she got an interview lined up, thanks to one of Jim's new partners. And she is going in for a job interview at a real estate company.
Jim set up a job interview for me today in Philly. It's with a real estate company, which is a great fit for me because I live in a house and I know what a bathroom is. I'm sorry. I am just very nervous because, honestly, this is all moving a lot faster than I expected. And because my resume can fit on a Post-it note.
It's funny for a couple of reasons. One, her resume is basically half a page. And I would like to read to you what Pam had on her resume.
Yes, please.
She was the office manager at Dunder Mifflin Scranton from July 2011 to present. She was receptionist August 2003 to June 2011. These are, by the way, the most concrete dates we ever get from anybody working at Dunder Mifflin. It's all very hand-wavy, including who worked first, Pam or Jim, but she started there in August of 03. Education, she went to the Pratt Institute of Art and Valley View High School, which I looked up, and it's I think it's the only school in the county that Scranton is in, the only high school. Looks nice. Looks like a nice high school, so she went there. And then her interests are her children, art, and painting.
Kind of redundant there. Kind of the same thing.
Yes, which comes up. But not a super robust resume, but as Mark, who we're going to meet in a second, says, like, well, it means that you stick around and you're not one to leave something that you're doing. Of course, that puts a little bug in Pam's ear for a conversation later with Jim. But what I find most interesting about this is Jim and Pam seem like they're getting along much better than they were before they went home on Valentine's Day to fight. And we don't see that argument. We don't really see how it came to be that she's going to agree to go to a job interview. Maybe she's doing it. It could be a bunch of different reasons, I guess. But they seem to be getting along. When they're in the office, like, they're kind of flirty and joking with each other, even though Jim is still busy, right? He gets pulled into a meeting. Later, he can't talk on the phone. But he says, you know, come by for dinner. And so they seem to be in a little bit better of a place, but, you know, maybe that's only skin deep as we get into this.
Yeah, so we meet Mark, who is bringing Pam around the office before conducting the interview, kind of giving her the lay of the land. And Pam right away notices and directly speaks to the camera that, oh my gosh, it's Michael Scott.
I'm Pam Helper.
Oh, hi. They call me Marky Mark around here because here at Simon Realty, we are one funky bunch. Come on, you guys, raise the roof when I say that. What are you, all temps again today? Let's go, Gangnam Style. He's heard Gangnam Style. He knows it, right? Not because he's an American. This is Carl. He's from here. He's from our neck of the woods. But Gangnam Style is great, isn't it?
Oh, my God. He's Michael Scott.
Like, we have a Michael Scott clone. It is like Philly Michael Scott. 100%. He has all the same jokes, inflections, interests, prejudices. Like, everything is Michael Scott. And it's this time, unlike all the other times that we're saying a couple characters take on Michael Scott attitudes, this time it's extremely intentional. This is meant to be a moment for Pam to be like, whoa, am I really going to take this on? You know, I already did the Michael Scott thing. I was already, you know, working with a person like this. Am I really going to walk into this office and start this all over again?
Yeah, and she sees that as a step backwards in a way, although she seems pretty amused by Mark, or at the very least can, like, play with him in his space. And I think the most striking bit to me was, you know, he's goofing around, like, singing, and he has a guitar, and he says all these kind of terrible things, but in a Michael Scott way. And then he says, do you think they like me, Pam? Do you think the people here like me? And it's like, that is the heart of Michael Scott, right? That he wants his office, his workplace to be a family. And that's what Mark's going for too. And we see the response from Mark's staff is pretty cool to his antics. They seem pretty used to it, not really fazed by it, mostly just ignoring him. And so, yeah, I think you're right. The parallels are definitely on purpose. And it's also just kind of fun to see an alternative dimension Michael Scott, both in the sense that Bob Odenkirk went out for the part, but also, like, this guy is a little bit different because he's like playing guitar and he has a lot of musical references that he actually understands, or Michael would normally mess those up. So it's a little bit of a different take on the same idea, but I loved every second that we see this Mark character.
What if Bob Dylan was your boss? I'm gonna do Dylan. Pam Halpern is my name. I've been at Dunder Mifflin for 7 years, 8 years, 8 years, man. Got the Dunder Mifflin blues, got the Pam Halpern blues, got prayer with the Pratt Institute. Tess, you have children?
two children,
and
yes.
Your art and painting? Mm-hmm. Kind of the same thing. Kind of the same thing. Sometimes I repeat myself, but that's just being Pam. Well, I'm kind of cute, and but I'm married, so leave that be. Looking for
How does Dylan do it? What if Bruce Springsteen was your boss?
Hey!
I like how he takes a moment to ask Pam about the cameras following him around. He's very intrigued by this. He's into the idea of being on camera. I think that this is like a bonus that Pam kind of comes with.
Yeah.
By the way, how long are these cameras going to be following you around? Because I think this is pretty cool. Pretty cool. Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Do you like that show?
Yes.
Well, I think they indulge themselves a little too much. I like Scripted.
But what we do find out is that the job that Pam is interviewing for isn't for an office manager job. It's for a receptionist job that is called an office manager.
I'm sorry, I thought this job was for the position of office manager.
It is. Yeah, you'd manage this office. You'd answer the phones and forward the calls and, go for a coffee run now and again.
So kind of like a receptionist.
Yeah, like a receptionist, but we call you the office manager because it's less demeaning.
This isn't something she wants. This is definitely a step backwards. Like, for one, having a boss just like Michael Scott, like you said, that feels like a step backwards, but it's also like, the devil you know, right? Like, she knows how to handle this type of person. But when she finds out that the actual duties and the job that she would be performing is just answering phones and getting coffee and not really managing the office at all, this is definitely something that she can easily turn down. She doesn't want this at all.
Yeah, it's a step backward in every way for her from where she is. And good for Pam for realizing that quickly and being, pretty set that this is not something she's willing to do. And we see her kind of leave this interview okay that she didn't get it, right? Because it was her decision. And I think that that's fantastic. I think that it's great that she does not sacrifice her career or what she wants to do just to take this job in Philly, right? That she's not willing to settle for this. And I think that's good. I think a Pam of several years ago would have settled for this and would have taken this job. And we've seen her grow to a point where this is not something that she's going to do.
So she has a date with Jim for later on. She tries to tell him about all of these feelings that she has about this new job and about, not taking it. But he's very busy. He can't hear it right now. But he says to come in at 8 o'clock into the office that he's going to order food in. Another one of those like workaholic kind of choices. It's like, really? You're going to order takeout into the office? Your wife is here in Philly. Like, dude, take her out to dinner. I mean, I get it. It's a TV show and they only have one set for this Philly location. And that's fine. But like he immediately was like, oh, you didn't get the job. That, he's sympathetic that she didn't get it. But it's more of the tone of like when she says that she intentionally didn't want it, that changes the perspective in their conversation. And he does, like, he listens to her and he sits down. He's like, okay, tell me all about it. But then he offers up next time it'll be better. You'll find a better fit job. And this is where Pam reveals that she doesn't necessarily want there to be a next time. That it seems like this little effort that she made to look for another place was kind of like, it was kind of like lip service, like I got the sense that in maybe their off-screen conversations that it was like, okay, yeah, I'll try to look for a job in Philly. But her heart really wasn't there. So she offered up this, token gesture, and it isn't really what she wants. I mean, that was probably one of the reasons why it failed in the first place. I mean, yeah, it was a terrible job and she shouldn't have taken it. So that was all the right thing. But and Jim is a little bit surprised that this is kind of like a not really where Pam wants to be, and And she's surprised that he's surprised. So we still have like a lot of this miscommunication between them that they are kind of saying what they want, where, you know, Pam wants to stay in Scranton and Jim wants to continue this awesome new job in Philly. And they can't seem to reconcile how to make that work because they're both trying to do a little bit for each other and not really saying what they mean.
Well, listen, you can't win them all, right? Mm-hmm. So the next interview has to be better.
I don't know.
What do you mean? Of course it will. You're amazing.
I know, it's just, even if it was a great boss and a great job, I don't know if I want this.
Huh. This is a little out of left field.
Is it? I liked our life in Scranton.
And I have started a business in Philadelphia.
I had the sense watching this that they're back and forth in this episode before it gets serious. Like, sometimes after an argument with your significant other, you kind of walk around on eggshells a little bit, right? You want it to be light and happy and not get near the third rail again. And maybe that's some of what's going on. And, you know, they're talking about this Mark guy that she met. And then the thing that's most telling to me is, you know, like you said, Jim says, well, this is kind of out of left blue. And she says, is it? Like, he's still not hearing what she's saying, I feel like. And they are left in this place of like, you know, she likes their life in Scranton and he started a company out of town. And what are they going to do? And so while they may have made some progress from where they were on Valentine's Day, the issue still remains, right? They may have had the argument and moved on past the argument, but the problem is still there. They still have these two paths that they can take, and each one is on kind of one side of the fork in the road, and it's got to be dealt with still. It's not over. It's not solved. It's just, it keeps coming around.
See, this is the first time that in all of these arguments that I'm seeing kind of with, I guess, wiser eyes and like, you know, in that through living your life, you kind of like realize the times to pick fights and the times to compromise and the times that like you realize when you look back in your past that you were just kind of being stubborn about things and you really were intentionally not being open to any new situation because you liked your old situation so much and you were holding on to it so tightly that you become blind to doing anything else. And that's in like little and big situations. And in this episode, this is the first time I'm seeing Pam kind of in that mindset of she loved what she had so much in Scranton that like, and she said this before in the show that it was, you know, she was working right every single day with the person that she loved. The job was fine. Like they were having a good time and it was fun and it was light and they got this house together and they had these kids together and everything's like super smooth. And she's getting like murals and stuff in Scranton and stuff's moving forward and it's looking good. Right. Jim's company having this monkey wrench is then like, puts Jim into like a much happier place where he is career wise. And Pam is now stuck holding on to that like great, wonderful thing that honestly at this point no longer exists. You know, like Jim has moved on and it's really not like his fault that this happened. It did happen. And like the idea of opening up the chance to be like, all right, let's try living in Philly for, you know, like, a few years, what could a few years do? You know what I mean? Like, if it turns out to be awful, you could always go back to Scranton. Like, that's one of those things where, like, when you get stuck in that mindset of nothing is ever going to be as good as what I had, that's like living in the past and it's like destructive to your future. And I feel like that's where these two are right now. And it's going to be a matter of time before, you know, Pam lets go of that. And I don't think that that's anything like it's her fault that she hasn't, or, you know, this has to come with time. You can't rush these things. It's not like someone can tell you like, stop being stuck and you're like, oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that because now I can move on. Like, you fixed it, right? But that's where I see this. And I think that it's a really real place that a lot of people find themselves in, especially when you are changing a life that you loved and it could be changing it for the better for something else that you also love. But it's a really hard transition point to see that when you're stuck in like this middle place.
We're so wise on this show. That's what people come listen, our wisdom.
We are wise. I mean, that's what, like, we say it all the time, or at least I say it all the time. This show makes me feel like I can reflect on like my own life and my own problems that I had, like, in these real ways. And that's what TV and sitcoms and stuff are for. It's for showing us that other people in the world have these similar problems to us and these similar struggles and choices that they make. And it's just a great way for us to reflect and at the same time, like, laugh, because it's a comedy, you know, like, and it's funny and we can like see ourselves in these situations and, you know, in our own lives at the, you know, it doesn't feel so funny, but here watching great TV like this and great writing really brings it all together. And I really like seeing these, I hate saying I like seeing them struggle, but I like a comedy where people have real things that they need to deal with. And this is definitely one of the heavier ones. And we're seeing that more and more. And it's like a roller coaster with Jim and Pam here. It's like, you know, they get a little bit better and then they get worse and then they get a little, they give a little bit and then they take a little bit. And so they're in this really rocky stage and we only have a few episodes left to rectify that or see where that's going.
The very end of this episode definitely puts the end in sight. We have Oscar going to go do weird inverted sit-ups hanging from the doorway while an ad is playing on his computer. And we see a little pop-up. The camera catches it as Oscar is like stuck because now his core is given out and people don't want to help him get down, which is all very funny. But we get this little pop-up. It says, coming this May. So this episode is based in February, so a few months out. The Office, an American Workplace. And the tagline is 10 years in the making, a look at the lives and loves of an average American small business office. No one catches it, right? They're all watching or ignoring Oscar or mocking him. But the camera catches it that, hey, this documentary that we've been shooting for 10 years is finally going to air, right? Something that Michael Scott talked about way back when he left. You know, hit me up if this ever airs. The time is coming. And it puts a bit of a clock on the rest of the series that, you know, we are approaching the end rapidly and that we are going to get to see the documentary. Because I remember that being a question in real time when the show was new. Like, is the documentary crew going to be around when the documentary comes out? Like, how are they going to handle that? And this is the first sort of dipping the toe in the water of what that may be like.
I love how they do this. I love that they don't just abandon the mockumentary style. I love that they lean into it. I love that it is a progression on the way out for this show for the last season. I just think it's so well done. They could have just as easily stopped the show and kind of like abandoned the idea that, oh yeah, we were filming a documentary. That was kind of the whole premise of this whole thing, but we kind of forgot about that. We're just going to like end, you know, but they don't. They have all of the, you know, little clues that go on when, you know, if you are involved in something like this, like a project like this. And I really like kind of seeing our characters react to that. I think it's great. And so going forward, we are going to see some more of that, which is even more exciting. And I guess that brings us to the end of the episode. And we'll be back next time talking about season 9, episode 17, The Farm. And until then, you can go and follow us over at tall_beats or individually at ISMH or at Tiff Arment. You can subscribe to become a member over at The Incomparable and get fun goodies at the end of the year, access to our members only bonus feed, and join us in the conference room, our members only Slack. And we do still plan to do some member things even when the show is done. I want to do one more trivia night with our members, you know, When that comes out, we will do the final three seasons of trivia. Nothing's on the books yet for a date, but that will still be there and for our members. And until next time, Stephen, avoid the homemade schnapps. I don't think it's really good for us.
No, it's, you don't end up getting hosed down in February.
I feel like a show pony.
And you look like one too.